Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Lynn Webster. Dr. Webster is the Associate Editor of the Special Population Section of Pain Medicine, the Chief Medical Officer of Pain Scripts, and author of the award-winning book, The Painful Truth. And if that wasn't enough, he is a documentary co-producer of It Hurts Until You Die. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Webster.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I want to take this podcast in a unique direction relative to other interviews in the sense that I want to focus on a very conceptual topic, and that is the dissemination of information in medicine. And I feel that you are uniquely capable of discussing this. And before we go into the topic of how clinical information is cultivated in the research realm, disseminated clinically, and eventually becomes policy, I'd like for you to discuss a little bit about your background, your professional career, and why that's so important for this conversation.
Sure, glad to. So I've had obviously a long career. And I started in practice in 1980 as an anesthesiologist. I'm board certified in anesthesiology, pain medicine, and addiction medicine. 1980s was, well, it was basically the beginning of a new era in a new field, the field of pain medicine. It was in the late 80s that I started, or mid-80s, that I started in an acute pain service in a private hospital in Salt Lake City. That got me really interested in pain medicine. I thought that this was a new field emerging in the field of medicine that I thought we could make a big difference in. So my acute pain service became a pain service, and I started consulting cancer pain in the hospital. And then by the early 90s, I began doing outpatient pain medicine and non-cancer pain. And I started my clinic. But this was also the time that we had very limited options available to us, even though we knew that a multimodal treatment model was obviously the most effective way to treat non-cancer pain. It wasn't really available in most places because of insurance. So you had to use the tools that were available to you. And medications, pharmacotherapy, physical therapy, although limited dramatically because of insurance limitations, it really became a pharmacotherapy approach. Over a period of time, I included other disciplines, including behavioral health, acupuncture, multimodal in approach, but really the primary treatment was pharmacotherapy. This is when opioids became center stage because they were effective, believed to be very effective, at least in acute pain, and it was believed that they would be very effective in chronic pain. And so opioids became a default treatment for a lot of people with moderate to severe, at the time it was called moderate to severe chronic non-cancer pain. Yet we were all very concerned about the legal as well as the medical risks involved with opioids. I, in particular, was very concerned about causing a problem, creating a substance use disorder, what we call addiction, basically opioid addiction. I didn't want to cause the problem, and I didn't even know how to detect it. I think most people didn't at the time. So that's the reason I became board certified in addiction medicine. I felt I had to understand how to identify people who were at risk and when they were at risk and what to do about it. So I wanted to see the full circle. If I was going to prescribe opioids, I had to know what the problems were so that I could manage the patients the best. And so I developed also the tool, the opioid risk tool that some people are familiar with, and that's become very popular worldwide. It's 5 countries that helps identify people and who are at risk of aberrant drug-related behavior. That's an overall umbrella term of people who are not taking the medicines as intended or as directed. So my career continued to go down that path, and I felt that policy was important as well, and research. So I began to do research. And I was recruited by pharmaceutical companies and device companies to participate in clinical trials. I developed my own research site, then later partnered with somebody to develop a contract research organization, a CRO, that we've used to contract with device companies and pharmaceutical companies, inventing new treatments available for my patients, because it takes years in research to finally get it approved. And I thought, we really don't have anything except opioids. So I wanted to be in the pipeline early so that my patients had access to it, access to all of the treatments. And that really led me to publishing, lecturing on what I discovered, what I learned in with my research, and then later to get into public policy.
Well said. It's a very comprehensive scope and a very impressive career trajectory, but I have to imagine that there was a lot of iterative learning that took place. Mm-hmm. So for example, while you are practicing, you may notice some systemic or legal component that you would then review and study and then incorporate into your clinical practice. And that may lead to certain research initiatives, certain other endeavors. Can you maybe give a few examples of kind of how iteratively you learned and picked up different skill sets?
Well, I think the easy one to talk about, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, my whole life has been about learning and modifying my approach and philosophy, honestly. I'll start with when I first started the treatment of pain, actually medicine, I never believed in behavioral therapy. I mean, I really didn't think that cognitive behavioral therapy, which we now refer to as cognitive behavioral therapy, but psychotherapy in any way, was of any benefit. I mean, when I was a pretty black and white thinker. I mean, you do surgery, you fix them. Yeah, you give a medicine, you fix them. So you either fix them or you don't fix them. And there was no in between. One of the major transformations in my mind and in my practice over 30 to 40 years was it's not so simple. And that life is complicated, the field of medicine is complicated, and the field of pain medicine is really complicated. So I began to understand that our behaviors are really a reflection of our life's experiences, our experience of pain and our risk for substance use are really a summary of everything we've experienced in life, both biological, meaning genetic, and environmental. So my experiences were patient by patient, year by year, learning and then modifying based upon what I felt I picked up and observed from my patients. And now I tell you, I'm 180 degrees from where I started. I thought psychiatry was a joke back in the 80s. Now I understand that basically, psychology and psychiatry is fundamental to everything we do because we're not a fix-em a profession. We're really, somebody we can't cure, but we can listen and we can help direct our patients. And if we don't listen, there's no chance that we can help the healing process. So it's a much more complicated, nuanced position I have today. Perhaps it's my age. But I think it's really my experience, my observations over time, that if you really are interested in making a difference, it first starts with telling patients that you believe them and that you're listening.
Well said. Let's maybe hone in a bit more granularly on this process of change. You had mentioned experience. So was there a particular clinical vignette, a patient scenario? Was there a research study, perhaps a combination of the both, that chip by chip helped to shift your mindset. Can you maybe talk about that process of the change in thinking?
Yeah, I think it's not, there wasn't really a, well, let me back up and say that there was one particular time that was critical to my awareness. And that happened during the acute pain service period, when I placed an epidural in a woman who was going to have a pneumonectomy for cancer. And this was at a time when I had never been trained to place a thoracic epidural. And for the, I don't know who all listens to this, but this is a placement of something in a narrow space in the mid of the back that can be very risky. And since I had never been trained to do it, this was an experiment in many ways. I was very afraid of causing harm, but I did it because I thought I had the potential of making a big difference. And at that time, people who would have a partial pneumonectomy would be placed on a ventilator after surgery and basically have an IV infusion of morphine to keep them sedated because it was so painful. They couldn't breathe, they couldn't take in a deep breath. But after placing this epidural and running an infusion of fentanyl, which is a bad name now, but it's also been very useful clinically, along with a little local anesthetic, my patient, and I call her Dorothy, she woke up after the operation pain-free. She woke up pain-free. She was able to take her endotracheal tube out of her mouth and ask when the operation was going to begin. We took her to the recovery room because she didn't need to go to the intensive care unit and be ventilated overnight with an IV infusion of morphine. We took her to the recovery room, and she sat up in the on the gurney in the recovery room, and within about 15 minutes, she was standing along the side of the gurney, and she had a left incision, and she, I said, Dorothy, can you lift your left arm? She says, you mean like this? The surgeon walks into the into the recovery room at this time, and his mouth was open, and he said, congratulations, Lynn. That was the time I knew that we were at the beginning of a new frontier in the field of pain medicine, and that we could do remarkable things because this had never been done, at least at my hospital and probably in my city and one of the few places in the country at the time. I didn't know, of course, the path that I would take at that time, but I did know I had to go down that path because I thought we could make enormous differences in the lives of everyone out there who have to have major operations. And so what if I could do that in the hospital, why couldn't I use that same technology, that same knowledge, to help people who suffer from chronic pain? Or at the time, first it was cancer pain. People were dying, and most people died of insufferable levels of pain. At that time, still way too many die of tremendous amount of pain. But to me, I saw this was this is where I had to go. I had to go because I felt like I could make a difference, and my colleagues were with me. I mean, I thought across the country, there were those of us at that stage in medicine in the late 80s and early 90s that we saw there was a huge need, and we had the tools available to help us make the difference. And so that's where the research comes in. So yet in order to change the patterns of in the medicine, you have to have evidence that what you're doing is helpful and that it makes a clinical improvement. And so how this that was a demarcation, that was a turning point, that was an important point in my career, in my life. But then it really continued with more interventional type treatments because I did a lot of interventions, spinal cord stimulators, intrathecal pumps. I was doing research for what we call Prealt. That's a kind of peptide that it worked in the spinal canal, only in the spinal canal. So we had to place pumps that infused medication into the CSF. And that was meant to replace all opium. It didn't turn out to work that way because of the side effect profile. But we did the research, and I probably did more research on that drug than anyone in the country or in the world at that time. But it laid the groundwork for the importance of being involved in research to try to discover what we could discover and advance that which made a difference. And be critical of that which didn't. Basically what I'm trying to say here is that from that point on, everything was a nuance. Everything was, every week I would observe something. The feedback I got from my patients, or when I went to conferences and gave lectures on what I had observed, and my research, and the feedback I got from my colleagues and from everyone who listened to me, helped mature me and helped mature my thought processes and channeled me to look at the field of medicine and what I was doing in different ways. And that's how I moved from believing psychiatry was quackery to psychiatry and behavioral medicine probably is fundamental to any part of healing that we could have.
Well, you know, we've been speaking for a few minutes now, and as you know, a world-renowned researcher and somebody who gives lectures that discusses many clinical studies and is quite quantitative in nature, and as somebody who observed you speak, I know that you are very disciplined in your research methodology. We haven't discussed any research, any numbers to date, and we've discussed your experiences, your observations. And even when I look at the opioid risk tool, which is available at the National Institute of NIDA, it's very quantitative. You're quantitating certain assessments. At what point do you see the blend between the observation and the data, the numbers and the perception, and how do you reconcile that in your own practice?
Well, first of all, I don't practice anymore, you're aware of, but it's always a process of the subjective and the objective, the quantitative and the qualitative. I think that you can't use numbers, quantitative data to direct patient care, because you have to have the patient's feedback. You have to have information, which is the qualitative part, to assess whether or not the numbers matter. Numbers are numbers, but that's not the outcome. I mean, we could have a statistical difference in something, but unless it makes a difference to the patient or a large number of patients, then it really doesn't matter. And we know that in a lot of clinical trials, statistical differences are very, a difference between one treatment or a treatment or no treatment may be very, very, very small. We see this with opioids, with most medicines, with most treatments, actually. The difference between a statistical difference and a difference between two different treatments can be very small. What's really important is what we learn from what the patients tell us. You know, when new medications, for example, would be, quote, detailed, you know, the pharmaceutical companies would come by, and they'd say they've got this new medication for this or that, and they wanted me to try it because it had all of these advantages. I would frequently try it if I felt that it was safe, but I would never make a judgment until at least 6 months after a patient was on it, because it's the patient's response that'll tell me whether or not the medication is what, you know, the company's detail people are suggesting that it has to offer. And of course, then we have to take into account the cost issue, whether or not the cost is worth worth it to the patient. But so it is always a blend of the qualitative and quantitative. Even the opioid risk tool is a numerical assessment of subjective evaluations mm-hmm. from the patient.
Right.
You know, it has a biological basis as well. I mean, there is a genetic component because there's that history of substance use disorder in the family or the personal substance use disorder or whether or not somebody has ADD or a PTSD. Those are all criteria that are used to evaluate risk, but a lot of that is not quantitative. It's more qualitative.
Yeah. I want to now transition to talk about the policy realm. We talked about the clinical, the research, and the mind shift that take place in kind of understanding how one relates to the other. For the listening audience, perhaps advocates, physicians, clinicians, more administrative physicians, who are now gravitating towards the policy realm, what is the difference in mindset that they need to carry over in order to be successful from your own personal experiences and what you've observed in general?
To be successful in the
policy.
In policy, well, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask that question. I think that I have a passion to make a difference. I've always had a passion to make a difference, and my involvement in the policy area is driven by that passion, and I'm not so sure I'm that successful at it. You know, if you're an advocate, you're an advocate, and you hope somebody listens, and you hope that you can make a difference. But that's pretty elusive, and it's really challenging. And what I've learned is that it is damn political. You know, it is not based. A lot of policy changes are driven based upon biases in beliefs, not facts. And that makes it really difficult. So you really have to understand what moves people emotionally more than factually. I mean, as I've said before, I mean, when we set up policies and you want to change something, if it doesn't emotionally connect with people in the policy area, it's probably not going to change. Even if it's fact driven, I mean, you can look at climate change. I mean, look how long it's taken us for the country, for the world to recognize climate change is a real threat to our security. But the facts have been around for 40 years. Only after we begin to see, you know, more hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and floods and et cetera, do people begin, because of their personal threat, fear that the climate may have on them, will there be policy changes? And that's even slow. You know, that's a slow process. So, to me, I think it's about trying to understand how my beliefs can help more people, and you try to find ways to convey that in a way that can be meaningful to them, not just to me.
No, certainly. Maybe let's broaden this at a more conceptual level. When I think about issues like abortion, gun control, to mention climate change, or even when it comes to vaccines, there's certain cognitive tendencies, if you will, that seem to reappear where, as you mentioned, it's very perception-based, it's very personalized. Is that something that's unique to the American ethos? Do you see that kind of across the world where there's just kind of like anti-intellectualism when it comes to the policy level, if I can maybe make such a bold statement?
Well, I think that's an area I can go into. I'm certainly not my field's pain medicine, you know?
Yeah.
My field is medicine. I'm a physician, and I have a lot of observations and feelings about how people respond and how we should interact with patients. But you know, I'm not a geopolitical person, so I'll leave that for you to discuss. I think that I'm concerned that facts don't drive a lot of policy, but emotion does. That's basically all I can say about that, I think.
No, fair enough. With the remaining time that we have, for those advocates who are in the pain space that may be experiencing similar frustrations, do you have any words of encouragement or any advice you can give them to keep them on the march or keep them going and when they feel perhaps dejected or hopeless?
Well, I think you don't win by giving up. You don't make any advances if you just stop or be in silence. If you're driven by trying to help patients, and if that's the focus, then you have to be involved. And it's also important, I think, not to be intimidated. Most of us, both of us, have been threatened. And both of us are here on this podcast because we are not going to be silent. And so I would say that no one wants to be exposed and verbally assaulted or harmed in a legal way, but you have to do what's right. I mean, to me, I think you have to do what you believe is right for not yourself, but for the larger world, our patients. I mean, I'm a physician, as we know, and so my focus is on my patients and on public health. And I think that if we stay focused, that is who we are most interested in, and that we are not silent, we are rational, and that we bring good thoughts that deserve consideration, then that's all we can do.
No, it's there's no easy solutions, because if there was, it would have been solved already.
That's right. That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Dr. Webster, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me today.